It is November the 13th. We're in Parsha Shmini on page 602. We're in the middle of the rules of Tuma and Tara, of purity and impurity. And we were in the middle of this pasuk, this verse, on Lamed Dalin 34. Really, we'll start from 33. We'll read 33 and 34 again. We started it, and I mentioned to you that there's a lot that is derived from this pasuk Lamed Dalet. So the pasuk says, "V'chol kli cheres, all earthenware utensils, asher yipol mehem al tocho, that one of these tamei things will fall into it. Kol asher b'selcho yitma, everything inside of it will become tamei. Ve'osos yishboru, and you shall break the utensil. There's no way to make it tohar, to make it pure. Mikol ha'ochel asher ye'ochel, from all food that shall be eaten, asher yavo alav mayim, that water shall come upon it, yitma, will become tamei. V'chol mashkeh asher yishasen, all drinks that shall be drunk, v'chol clean, all utensils, yitma, will become tamei." Now, so we had mentioned last time that the way that a kli cheres, that an earthenware utensil works, is that it is not... The utensil does not become tamei when an item touches it on the outside, which is normally, if you have any kind of other material, that can become tamei. When something tamei touches it, it becomes tamei. But an earthenware utensil, the outside of it does not contract tuma. The inside does. However, the way the inside becomes tamei, it doesn't have to touch as long as the tamei item becomes suspended in the airspace of the utensil becomes tamei. Once the utensil becomes tamei, it can turn around and make other things tamei that are inside of it.
Why is that? Just by putting it, not touching it, but just by putting it in the middle of the...
Yeah, that's the rule. That's
just the way it is.
Yeah, that's Torah says. It's unique to tummy. It's unique to earthenware utensils. Yeah,
right.
Now, to ceramic. Now, the one could be tempted to think that what's happening is, let's assume that the thing that's suspended in the middle of the kli, of the utensil, let's assume that it is a dead rodent, a dead lizard. It's suspended in the middle here. So one might have thought that the way it works is it's as if the entire airspace is filled with lizard. Mm-hmm. That's what one might have thought. But that's not the way it works. The way it works is that when the lizard, dead lizard, is suspended in the airspace, the utensil becomes tamei, and then the utensil can turn around. If there's food in the utensil as well, the food will become tamei. So it's not that the lizard is making the food tamei. The lizard is making the utensil tamei, and then the utensil turns around and makes the food tamei. Why is that important? The reason it's important is because as tumah moves from one thing to another, it diminishes in strength. It becomes less potent. So that you start with the item that is itself the source of tumah. So a dead lizard is the source of tumah. We call that an av hatumah, a father of tumah. It is tamei. By being in the airspace of the utensil becomes tamei. We call that a rishon lituma. It's a first level tuma. First level means first level of contracted tuma. It's not the source of tuma. That would be the av. That would be the father of tuma. Rather, it's the rishon. It's the first level of contracted tuma. Then the food inside the utensil becomes tamei from the utensil. The food is a sheni, is a second level of contracted tumah. The reason why that's significant is the following. Only food and drinks can become a sheni lituma, can become a second level of contracted tumah. Utensils can only be a rishon, can only be a first level of contracted tumah, can never be a second level of contracted tumah. Therefore, if you have inside, let's say this is an earthenware utensil, and there's a lizard, dead lizard, suspended from here. So the kli, the utensil, becomes tamei. In the utensil, there's a grape, and there is a metal earring. A metal earring is a utensil.
Right.
The grape will also become tame, because the utensil is the first level, Rishon, and then the grape will become a second level, will be a second sheni, a second level. But an earring cannot become a second level. It can only be a first level. Mm-hmm. And since the lizard didn't touch the earring is metal, has to be touched to become tame, right. The lizard didn't touch the earring, so the earring didn't become a Rishon, didn't become a first level.
Right.
The earring is touching the utensil, touching the bowl. The bowl is a Rishon, is a first level. So the only thing the earring can become would be a sheni, a second level. But earrings can't become a second level because it's a kli, it's a utensil. So only food or drink can go to that second level, but not utensils. So that's why it's significant to know the system of how it works. The lizard makes the utensil tameh. That then in turn makes whatever's inside of it tameh, but only food and drink, not other utensils.
You mentioned that it's not as though the kli is full of lizard.
Right, because right? If that were the case, it would be like the lizard were touching the earring.
Right. Do we say that the tumah is moving from the lizard to the interior of the kli via the air? Is the air important to you?
It seems to be that it's the way it works.
Is the air becoming tummy?
Apparently not.
If you had a cherry suspended on a string,
it would not be tummy.
It would not. So the air does not count in this. It doesn't acquire tumah.
Right. Right.
That's interesting.
That's the thing. You want to know, does the cherry become tummy because it is in the airspace mm-hmm. of a tummy? I don't remember if that happens or not. That's a good question. I think not, but I do not remember. It's a good point. But at any rate, that's this system is how it works. Yeah.
Now, I have another question. I keep picturing, what if there was a earthenware or ceramic utensil of some sort, something like a spatula or something, that doesn't have
an interior. Yeah, an interior. When it doesn't have an interior, it cannot become tummy. It has to have an interior. Now, an interior is not defined. It doesn't have to be a dramatic interior, even if it's just a little bit of a...
But if it's perfectly flat,
right, should not be able to become tummy. Right. For ceramic, for earthenware.
Yeah.
As opposed to metal.
Yeah.
Metal can.
Yeah.
Now, the way that this works is very, very important, and I'm going to tell you about it now, even though it will come up later in the Chumash. But the reason I'm going to tell you about it now is because it doesn't come up until Parshas Chukas, which is in Sefer Bamidbar, which will take us at our rate a couple of years to get to. Right. So I'm going to tell you about this now. You know that there's a rule, really, Dr. Fari brought it up in the last class, that there is a type of tumah that fills up a room, and that's called tumas meis. The tumah that comes from a dead person has a halakha of ohel. It fills up the entire room. So if there's a dead person in this corner, the whole room is tame. There's one other form of tumah like that, which is tsara'as, but I'm going to focus only on the dead person. So then it fills up a whole room. That means anything in the room now becomes tame. It just is if it's touching everything in the room. It fills the room up. The only thing in a room where there's a dead person present, the only thing in the room that will remain tahor, the Torah says in Parshas Chukas, is an earthenware utensil that is completely sealed on the top. Now, what's the reason for that? The reason is because an earthenware utensil has the unique property that the outside does not contract tumah. Only the airspace contracts tumah. So therefore, if you seal it on the top, the tumah has no way of getting inside this earthenware utensil. So it's a unique property of only an earthenware utensil that it can actually block the tumah of a dead person, where nothing else can do that. And the Gemara speaks of cases where, for example, there's a Mishnah that speaks about where there is a dead person in a room. The room is now filled with the tumah, and there is either a broken area in the ceiling, or there's a skylight in the ceiling, which means the tumah will also now go up through that opening. It can go through that opening. And then it can infect things that are on the next floor, in theory. But if there's an earthenware utensil that is jammed into that breach, it will block the tumah, provided that it's jammed into it with its outside facing the tumah. But if you jam it in the other way, then the tumah will now infect the earthenware utensil, and then it can still go further. So if it's jammed in the proper way, with the back of it, the bottom of it, filling up that hole, it will stop the tumah from going beyond that area. So it's a unique property that exists only with an earthenware utensil, and that is derived from here. The Torah speaks about it again later on in Parshas Chukas, but this is the understanding behind why it works. Because an earthenware utensil, ceramic utensil, cannot become tummy from the outside, only from the inside. So that's a unique property.
Well, Rabbi, who cares? I mean, tumah. I mean, you know what I mean? What difference does it make?
So it doesn't make it... No, it's
today, but if you take that vessel and take it into the temple, then you got a big problem.
Right. There's several... Today, it matters to a Kohen.
Okay.
A Kohen has to know whether he's allowed to walk into the room or not.
Right.
So that matters to the Kohen. And then...
So there are people that keep in their houses... ashes.
Okay, so there's a question
and
with
put it in earthenware.
Yeah. So ashes may.
And you may not know. Yeah, but you don't know.
Yeah, ashes might not be tame anymore because once you burn it to that extent, it may not be tame. Okay. But we'll talk about that Mitzvah Hashem when we get to Parshas Chukas. That's a whole. No, that's all discussion.
No.
It's a strong question.
It is.
Yeah.
It happens.
Yeah, but morgues and hospitals. I mean, this is a real issue for Kohanim. So that's why it's relevant. For the rest of us who are not Kohanim, it is relevant only when there is a Beis HaMikdash because of, you're right, taking the utensil into the Beis HaMikdash. Or if we are in a room and we become Tamei, we can't go into the Beis HaMikdash either.
Right, right.
So that it's relevant. Or eat a carbon.
Right.
Even though we don't have a Beis HaMikdash, the Kohanim are still try to be machmir about not being exposed to dead bodies.
Mm-hmm. Right? Well, that's not because of the Beis HaMikdash. There's a separate law that a Kohen, a male Kohen, may not... come in contact with a dead body.
And that's still enforced today.
Yeah, it has nothing to do with the Beis HaMikdash.
Except the direct members.
Only people? Or is that animals also?
Only people.
Okay.
Only people. Tumah today has very little practical application other than family purity. That's one, that's really the biggest application today. And the other real application today is with the Kohen and come in contact with dead bodies. Those are the two real areas of tumah today that are relevant today.
Yeah, I read something recently, maybe you all read it also. I forget where, but they discovered dead bodies near some place in Israel.
Yeah.
But the dead bodies nearby and the flight paths of the planes might have to...
Yeah, that can become an issue. There is another, it's largely... not relevant, but it can be relevant. There's another area where tumah becomes a big deal, and that is if someone goes behind the wall of the Temple Mount. Someone wants to go over there, then that's entering the compound of the Beis HaMikdash, and most authorities would say the person has to become tahor as best as possible before going in there.
So if a Kohen did come into contact today with a dead body, is there a way for him to remove that?
No. No, but it does not permit him to continue to become tummy. He just has to get away from the dead body and remain away, and that's it.
So he just has to do the best he can, but there's no remedy.
Right, there's no remedy right now.
There's no remedy. Going to make for the bomb.
No, not until we get back the Parah Aduma, the red heifer. Right.
But can he still do it, or he has to stop his...
He can do it.
Yeah, he can probably still, all Kohanim...
Oh, well, we hope not, but right. That's why they bury the relatives of Kohanim on the periphery of the graveyard, so they can visit, so the living can visit the deceased from outside of the graveyard, right? Because they can't come in, so they stay on the outside.
And that go for the spouses also?
It's only the males. Only males. The women do not have the restriction. But it does apply to the boys, the sons.
The sons.
Yeah. Now, we also mentioned last time that, and we'll talk more about this in a few psukim, in a few verses, but we also mentioned last time that that food, all food, does not become tame until it first goes through a process that enables it to become tame. And that process is that it comes in contact with liquid. If it comes in contact with liquid, then from going forward, it can become tame. But until it comes in contact with liquid, it cannot become tame. So you have, let's take that example of the grape. A grape growing from the ground, going from a vine, obviously it gets wet during its growth. But as long as it's attached to the ground, coming in contact with liquid is irrelevant. It does not enable it to become tame. So I have a dry grape, which I pluck off of the vine. That grape, even if something tame touches it, will not become tame, because it has not yet become enabled, which, remember that confusing term, mukshar, kosher, to become tame. It's not yet enabled. But once that grape gets wet, even after it's dried, but it had become wet after it was detached from the ground, now it is enabled to become tame. It's not tame yet. So I have a grape, I pull it off the vine, something tame touches it, it's not tame. Then this grape gets wet, I wash it, so now, and then I dry it. The grape is not tame, but it is now enabled to become tame. So now if something touches it that is tame, it will become tame. So my example of the ceramic utensil with the lizard hanging in there and the grape is in the utensil, that grape will only become tame if at some point in its lifetime, in the grape's lifetime, after it was detached from the ground, it came in contact with liquid. Even though it is dry right now, it will then become tame. But if it never came in contact with liquid, then even though it's in the ceramic utensil, it cannot become tame.
So if you eat it and it becomes wet in your mouth?
So yes, at that point it can theoretically become tame, but there's nothing tame in your mouth.
But it doesn't make you tame.
And it's not retroactive anyway.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is that why we wash our hands before we eat wet fruits
and vegetables? Yes. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Similar to, right, I'll talk about that, we'll talk about that separately. Yeah, but yeah, just, yeah.
Can we eat foods that have not been enabled? Is that
yeah,
okay?
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with it.
Okay.
There's nothing wrong with it. And foods that are tame, as I mentioned last time, according to the Torah, do not make you tame. If you eat tame food, you don't become tame. You become tame by touching things that are tame and by lifting things that are tame. But if someone would take a tame item and stick it back in the back of your mouth and you would swallow it, it would not make you tame. There's only one type of tumah that can make a person tame from eating it. And we'll get to that later. It has to do, it's a very specific case. Now, this again, this is all from a Torah level. As we mentioned last time, there are layers upon layers upon layers of rabbinic rules, but we're focusing on what the Torah says about Tumah and Tara. Now, this enabling, this heksher, becoming kosher to become tameh, as I mentioned, the food has to touch liquid. What is the definition of liquid? So there are, the Torah recognizes seven liquids. There's Shiva Mashkim. There are seven liquids. Other than these seven, liquid would, even though it's scientifically liquid, it would not enable an item to become tame. It has to be one of the seven liquids. I'll put them on the board. So the liquids, I'm going to put the Hebrew only because it has an acronym. So the Hebrew is, so I'm going to use the script, is, that's yad, hand, shachat, slaughtered, dam, blood. A hand slaughters and there's blood. So those are the seven, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. What do they stand for? So the yud stands for yayin.
Wine.
Wine is considered a liquid. The dalid stands for, well, there's really two dalids. Mm-hmm. We'll pick one of them. Is devash.
Milk.
Honey.
Honey.
Now, this does not mean...
bee honey.
Actually, this means...
Date honey?
No. This means... Oh, boy. I don't remember. It's embarrassing. Okay, but it means honey. I think that might actually mean bee honey. Okay, but I don't remember. The shin stands for shemen, oil. Of course, it means olive oil. Oil. The ches stands for chalav.
Milk.
Milk. Milk is considered a liquid. The tes stands for tau.
Dew.
Dew is considered a liquid.
Would rain also fall under dew?
Rain will fall under the mem, as you'll see. Dalid is dam. Is blood. Blood is considered to be a liquid. And the mem, of course, is mayim, is water. Those are the seven liquids. Absent from this list are fruit juices other than wine. Now, most fruit juices that we get have water added. When you buy a fruit juice to drink, you buy orange juice in the store, there's often water added to it in the ingredients. But if you have a pure fruit juice, you take an orange and you squeeze the orange and get orange juice, that is not a recognized liquid in the Torah. And if that orange juice touches a food, that does not enable that food to become tameh. It has to be one of the seven liquids. Wine does enable it. Actually, oil as well. Shemen, oil, olive oil does as well. But other liquids do not, the fruit juices generally do not, are not counted as a liquid for in this regard. In other regards, the Torah does consider it to be a liquid, but in this regard, it's only these seven liquids.
Even coconut water?
So I assume that coconut water is considered to be a juice of the coconut. I'm assuming it's not just pure water, but it's considered to be the juice of a coconut. In which case, it would not. That's right. Coconut milk
had,
or whatever they call it.
I don't think they had coconuts in this.
Yeah, they probably did not.
So
yeah.
That
yeah.
Non-question.
Another important property for this enabling is that the liquid has to be a liquid that the owner of the food wanted the food to come in contact with this liquid.
Hmm.
Now, wanted doesn't mean that you necessarily poured it yourself, but that you were pleased with the fact that the liquid touched it. So if water was poured on it, water hit it, whatever it is, and that was something which, as far as you were concerned, was a good thing, then that would enable the item to become tameh. But if blood hits the grape, you had no interest in blood hitting the grape, and therefore it would not enable the grape to become tameh. It would have to be that the person wanted or was happy with the liquid coming in contact with the item.
So when would a person be happy with blood coming into contact with a food?
When one slaughters an animal.
It's the animal's own blood. It's touching the animal's own flesh.
After it's dead.
So after it's dead, when the blood is running.
Mm-hmm. So there a person wanted the blood to come out of the animal, was happy with what's happening. There's a process of shechita is what the person wanted over here. And that would enable the meat to now become tameh.
Oh, I see. So as soon as the shechita is done.
Depending on the circumstances, I mean, the Gemara discusses the various details of that, but that would be an example where the blood is desirable.
Is there a relationship between kashrus and tameh when it comes to...
As we mentioned last time, the Torah uses the same words.
Right.
Tuma and tara,
right.
And a tameh animal means a non-kosher animal. A pig is a tameh animal. A tahar animal is a kosher animal. A cow is a tahar animal. So the Torah uses the same terms, which means they must be related. But it doesn't readily jump out at you how they're related, because it seems to be two entirely different discussions. But even in this parasha, we started off discussing kosher and non-kosher, then we slipped into tumah and tara, and as you'll see, we're going to slip back to kosher and non-kosher. So it does seem like they are related.
I was just thinking because of the blood situation.
Yeah, yeah, right. Yeah, yes.
When you pluck the grape from the vine, if the grape happens to be wet when you pluck it, does it have to dry before becoming enabled? Or
it depends whether you wanted the liquid on that grape when you plucked it.
But if you just in theory happens to be,
let's say you hose down the grapes because you wanted to clean them.
Oh well, then
before you pluck them off the vine, then you pluck it off the vine. Well, it's still wet. Then it will now be enabled.
Right. So it's an interesting thing that intention is part of it.
Yes. Role. Yes. Yeah. That's the Gemara. The Gemara makes it very clear that it has to be, if not intention, at least you have to be
happy after the fact.
Yeah, pleased with the fact that it happened.
It's very interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
And in the past, did everybody know all of these?
As I mentioned at the outset with the Tumah and Tahara discussion, we are so unfamiliar with it because it's so not relevant to us. But we are familiar with a lot of complicated laws. Right, Shabbos is pretty complicated, and we know a lot of stuff about Shabbos. And I think that I'm assuming this is true. When people are becoming religious and they find out how intricate the laws of Shabbos are, and they discover that a lot of people know a lot of intricate details about the laws of Shabbos, mm-hmm. and I think it's surprising how much people know. So I think with the Tumah and Tahara, we're victims of the fact that we're just not practicing it. So to us, it seems like, but even that having been said, the Gemara does say that the laws of Tumah and Tahara are complex and that it is saying something to say that in the generation of Chizkiyahu, the King Chizkiyahu, that even the children knew the laws of Tumah and Tahara. When the Gemara wants to show how great the scholarship was of the Jewish people at that time, it uses these laws as the example. Even the children, the men, the women, the children, everybody knew even the laws of Tumah and Tahara. So it does become the example of great scholarship. So yes, it is something.
And the Kohanim had to be
asked. Yes, Kohanim had to know it. Yes. Kohanim had to know it. But not everybody really had to know it.
Is there a way to make a tummy food or drink tahor again? Can it be rescued?
Yeah, so food can be put in the mikveh, in theory. Sometimes putting in the mikveh will ruin it. A loaf of bread, what are you going to do with it? But in theory, it could be put into the mikveh.
That would be the only way.
Right. Drinks, you can't put a drink in the mikveh.
So there's no way to recover
drinks other than water. Water can become tahor. Now, water, this is a fascinating thing, and hygienically you may not like this, but it's a fascinating idea. The way that you make water tahor is not by dunking it in the mikveh, but by attaching it to the mikveh. Meaning, I have a cup of water that's tameh. I have a mikveh here.
Mm-hmm.
So what I do is I submerge it in the mikveh until the two waters touch. They just have to touch briefly.
Mm-hmm.
What that does is it makes the water in the cup mm-hmm. part of the mikveh, and then it becomes tahor.
Mm-hmm.
But that's unique to water, because apple juice can't be part of a mikveh. Mm-hmm. Only water can be part of a mikveh.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not the same mechanics as dunking something. It's attaching it to the mikveh. It becomes literally part of the mikveh. Right? And it's called hashaka, which is the same word as for kissing. Right? Exactly. That's the right. That's the terminology, right? Okay, so so these are the getting a flavor over here of the Tumah and Tahara.
Tasting the bromine, I'm sorry.
let's read on just a little bit. I'm now in 604, Pasuk Lamed Hey, verse 35. If any of the corpses of the things that we spoke about until now fall onto this earthenware utensil, it becomes tameh, meaning into it, it becomes tameh. Tanur v'chirayim, an oven, how do they translate this?
Oven.
And a stove. Utots shall be broken. Tmeim, they are tameh. Utmeim yulachem, they shall be tameh to you. And what that means is that there's two main things that we derive from here. First of all, the type of utensil that can become tameh, this earthenware utensil, we've already mentioned before, it has to have a toch, it has to have an inside. But in addition to that, it has to be like an oven and a stove. Now, we today picture an oven and a stovetop, a stovetop and an oven, we don't even necessarily associate them with each other. The stovetop can be on a counter somewhere and the oven can be separated. But we look at it as something which is embedded in a cabinet, or is this large appliance? I remember growing up, I didn't realize that an oven is not attached to the house. I just thought the oven was, you know, it just looked like the counter, the oven, right? But I just didn't realize it's something you can replace and take in and out. Just to me, it seemed like a dishwasher. It seemed like it's part of the, you know. So the way an oven looked in before electrical and gas ovens was a round object, a large round. I guess it's like a cylinder, except that it was usually bent in, which is the word tapered. Yeah, but there's a word for it. Not a cylinder. It's not a cone either, because it's doesn't come to a point.
Sort of a flask-like shape.
Yeah, it's like a, right, but it doesn't come to a dome either. It didn't have a top. It was like a cylinder, but tapered a little bit, and that would, the heat would be concentrated and move towards the top. It would be very hot that way, and it did not have a top. You could lay a grate across it, so you could put something on top of it, but it didn't have a roof, and it did not have a bottom. The fire was put on the ground, and this was over the area of the fire. And there was always a ventilation part on the side of the, like a ventilation hole on the side of the oven.
So how did they keep it up?
It was a large object, and it rested on the ground.
It rested on the ground.
Right. Okay. The main point being, it was mitaltel, it was movable. Ovens were a movable item. It was a utensil that was movable. They were large, and perhaps you didn't move around too often because you also needed to make sure that the area that you had it was an area that was suitable for burning things. But it was a movable item. You took it with you when you moved. It was just part of your, you know, furniture. Part of your furniture. Right, right. So what the Torah is saying over here is that in order for a utensil to be something that can become tame, it has to be a movable utensil. Something which is not movable, either because it's embedded to the ground or embedded to the house, or, as I mentioned last time, that it's the type of utensil that when you fill it, it's too heavy to move, then it cannot become tame. So what would be an example in our day of something that when it's filled, it's too heavy to move? A large dresser. A large bookshelf, when they're filled, you can't move them. Now, you could if you get a lot of big, burly people in there, but normally they're not movable when they're filled up. Items that are too heavy to move when they are full cannot contract tumah. They're exempt from tumah. So that's derived from here, because the largest item that can become tumah is one like an oven, which is a movable object. That's one thing that we derive from this verse. Another thing we derive from this verse is, I kept alluding to this last time, the last three words, utmei miulachem, they shall be tamei to you. Mm-hmm. We derive from there that if you choose to keep a tamei utensil, that's fine. No one's telling you that you have to get rid of your tamei utensil. It happens to be that a ceramic utensil cannot become tahar, and if you do not want a tamei ceramic utensil in your house, you have to break it. There's nothing else you can do with it. But if you want to keep it as a tamei utensil, that's perfectly fine. You don't have to get rid of it. You need to be aware of the fact that it's tamei, so you don't want to put into that utensil things that need to be tahar. So if you have carbon food, if you have truma, you don't want to put it in there. But the item is permitted to be kept around even though it is tamei. Now, this is significant because, for example, if you have a fork, and it's a meat fork, and you didn't realize it, and you took piping hot cheese lasagna out of the oven, and you took the meat fork and you jammed it into the lasagna, and he goes, "Oh no!" And you take it out, you call the rabbi. It needs to be koshered. Okay, koshering isn't that complicated, but a lot of people, it takes some time. You know, whatever it is, I got to boil up some water. I got to. Right? So I have my bag of koshering things. Any good kosher kitchen has a bunch of stuff that needs to be koshered, especially if you have a lot of different people in the kitchen at different times. So there's a bunch of stuff, and that, you know, we keep a running tally. It's sitting there, and then every so often I get around to making things kosher again. So you got these things that are non-kosher. So I have my fork, I have a spoon. I have a spoon, and it needs to be koshered. So it's clean. It needs to be kashered. So I decided, I want to have some ice cream. So I take the ice cream out of the freezer. I put it in a bowl, and I want to eat the ice cream. Problem is that I don't have any spoon to use for the ice cream. All my spoons are dirty. I don't want to wash a spoon. So there's a clean spoon right here in my need to be koshered bucket. So everything's cold. It's cold ice cream. So there's no onions, right? So can I use the spoon that needs to be koshered? Can I use it to eat my ice cream? And the answer is no. You can't. Because Chazal, our sages, were worried that if you would do that, you would forget that it needs to be koshered and you'd end up using it with hot also. So you're not allowed to use items that need to be koshered. You're not allowed to keep them around and use them as non-koshered items that you can't do. That is rabbinic in nature. You're not allowed to do that. Whereas, if I go to my next door neighbor's house, he's not Jewish, and he offers me kosher ice cream. There's a heksher on there. He shows me the container. It's got an OU on it, and he serves it to me in his ceramic bowl with his spoons, non-plastic, he offers it to me. They're clean. I'm allowed to eat it, even though his bowl is not kosher and his spoon is not kosher. But it doesn't matter because he's allowed to keep it around, and I'm allowed to eat from his things as long as it's cold. That's not a problem. But from my things, I can't do that because Chazal were afraid I would end up using it with hot. So the fact that the Torah is saying over here, this tameh utensil, you're allowed to keep it around and you're allowed to use it, right? Just don't use it with things that need to be tar. Don't use it with truma. Don't use it with karbanos. But you're allowed to keep it around and use it with other foods. Then that's very significant that the Torah is saying it's okay. You're allowed to have that. You don't have to make sure every item in your house is tar. There was a person last week who was very bothered by that. But that is what the Torah says, that it's okay to have tameh things in your house. And it's part of life that people become tameh, people become tar, items become tameh, items become tar. With your kosher home, you're trying to make it that nothing ever becomes not kosher. Unfortunately, mistakes happen, but your goal is that things remain kosher all the time. But with tumah and tara, that's not the way it works. Things go in and out of tumah and tara. That's natural. That's just the way it goes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but they have the antidote. We don't.
That's true. Well, we have a mikvah for those things that a mikvah works for. That we do have. But we don't need it because, as we've said, it's not so relevant today. Right. Now, what about mikvah? So that's the next pasuk. Pasuk Lamed Vav 36. Ach mayon uvor. However, a spring, a mayon, a spring, ubor, that's a water hole, a hole in the ground that has rainwater in it. Mikve mayim, a gathering of water, yet tahar, it shall be tahar, which means it can make you tahar, or it can make an item tahar. If a person or an item becomes tameh, they can immerse in this gathering of water in the ground, and it will make the person tahar again. That is this is the source for mikveh. But v'nogea b'nivlasam yitma. But if someone touches one of the corpses that we mentioned before, a dead animal, whatever it is, a dead lizard or something like that, he'll become tamei. That sounds redundant. We've already said the person can become tamei. So our sages explain, if a person is in the mikvah, literally immersed in the mikvah, and is holding a dead lizard, the mikvah will not make that person tahar. The person is tamei. That's called tovel Visheretz biyado. Oh, goes to the mikvah while holding on to the item that makes him tameh. One might have thought, well, if I'm already tameh and I immerse in the mikvah, it removes the tumah. So all the more so, if I'm immersed in the mikvah, I'm sitting in the mikvah, and I grab hold of the lizard, the mikvah should prevent me from becoming tameh. No. It doesn't work that way. If you're touching that lizard, the dead lizard, even though you're in the mikvah, you become tameh.
What does the lizard do to the mikvah?
The lizard doesn't do anything to the mikvah. Well, doesn't do anything to the mikvah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, good question, but does not do anything to the mikvah.
If
whatever's in the water, said the dead lizard. I'm going to check it right now, make sure there isn't one. But the person's not touching
it. We hear the screams over here, so I don't know.
I know. The person's not touching the dead, creepy crawly, whatever it is.
They're fine.
They're fine, okay.
Yeah, yeah. Most creepy little things don't make your person vomit.
I know, but no. if we don't know which ones they are that
No.
in the water.
Dead roaches don't make a person vomit.
I know, but it's okay. The little...
You'd think they would.
The caterpillars and centipedes and things.
Like that. No, they don't make a person tummy.
So okay. Such a person who's holding the dead lizard becomes tummy.
Make sure
do they exit, drop the lizard, and then they can go back in?
Yeah, they could throw the lizard out.
Okay. Right.
And by the way, this type of tummy will not ruin a woman's going to the mikvah, because a woman's not going to the mikvah for this type of tummy.
Okay.
She's going for family purity, which is a whole different reason, so it wouldn't be affected by this. But a person who's trying to become tahor to go to the Beis HaMikdash and is in the mikvah holding or touching a lizard, they're not tahor. They are tameh. Mm-hmm. The person remains tahor. This is used as an idiom. Tovo b'sheretz b'yado. This phrase, going to the mikvah while holding a sheretz, holding a dead lizard, is used as an idiom for a person who is doing teshuva but holding on to the avera. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, they're saying I'm sorry. On the other hand, they're still doing it. So that's called tovel v'sheretz biyada. You're going to the mikvah, but you're still holding on to it. I mean, that doesn't help. Mm-hmm. You got to get rid of the item or get rid of the sin and do teshuva. But you can't. Do teshuvah while holding on to the sin. That's used as a phrase. One more pasuk. Two more. We'll do two more pasukim here. We'll finish the paragraph. That we've already discussed the points this we're going to say over here. V'chi yipol min yivlasam al kozera zeirua asher yizareya. That has a good ring to it. So if from these corpses we've discussed will fall on any, let's use the English over here, on any edible seed that has been planted, which takes away from the great reed over here, the if you were to translate it literally, it would fall on any seed that has been seeded. Any seed that is seeded that has been seeded.
Sowable seed that has been sown.
Something like that. It's the Torah using the Hebrew using the noun as a verb and the verb as a noun, but if it shall touch anything that is growing, tahar hu, the item is tahar because, as we mentioned before, it has not yet been enabled to become tamei, and since it has not yet been mukshar, hasn't been enabled to become tamei, even though the tamei item touches it, it will not become tamei. However, v'chiyutan mayim al zera, but if water, as we mentioned, really it's all seven liquids, any of the seven liquids, shall touch this growing item after it was detached from the ground, and then v'nafal meniv lasam alav, and then one of these corpses shall fall upon it, tamei hu lachem, then it shall be tamei for you. And this is the psukim that we mentioned before, that first you have to have an enabling process, then the item can become tamei. So these are the psukim right here that tell us about that. So just to tell you where we are at this point, I do not want to go further because it's a new paragraph and we're very shorthanded tonight, so I don't want to leave everybody in the dust. So just to show you where we are right now, we've discussed kosher and non-kosher eating, kosher and non-kosher animals, birds, fish, grasshoppers. We discussed all that. We discussed the tumah that can come from a dead non-kosher animal, a dead non-kosher animal, a dead pig, a dead camel. We discussed that. We discussed the tumah that can come from a dead rodent, specific rodents, the eight that we spoke about, lizard, and it's not clear exactly what all of them are, toads, mice, those various eight rodents, I guess. The lizard's not really a rodent, but those small creatures. We discussed that. And we talked about the various utensils and becoming tamei and the unique quality of the ceramic utensil and things like that. What we have not discussed is what about wild animals or large creatures, bears, snakes. We're going to discuss that coming up for Tuma and for Tara. We've also not discussed what happens with a dead kosher animal, a dead cow, a dead sheep. Now, if it's slaughtered properly, for sure it's not tame. But if it wasn't slaughtered properly, it died on its own or it was shot, so it's a nivela. It's a dead, non-kosher, kosher animal, right? Because it wasn't slaughtered properly. That's an nivela. We haven't discussed that tumah either. So the next paragraph is going to cover those large wild animals, and it's also going to cover the dead kosher animals that were not slaughtered properly for tumah and for tara. After we mention those, we'll segue right back into kosher and non-kosher foods for the end of the parsha. The Torah is going to kind of give a summation of the whole concept over here. So, Mirtz Hashem, next week, hopefully we will discuss this last paragraph in the parsha and we'll cover those last points of Tumah Tara and kosher non-kosher.
Could one come across a dead kosher animal and not know if it might have been slaughtered properly?
Yes, yeah, that can happen. That can happen. But we presume that it was not slaughtered properly unless you know.
For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.